How to survive ancient Egypt. Let's say you want to spend a summer working outside, building a little muscle while getting a little dirty, a little exercise, and maybe a tan. So you travel back to ancient Egypt's Old Kingdom for a summer job in the year 2550 BCE to work on the greatest community service project in human history, the tomb for the pharaoh Khufu. The ancient Egyptians called it the Horizon of Khufu. You probably know it as the Great Pyramid of Giza. You'll work dawn to dusk for 4 months, dragging stones weighing between 1 and 80 tons through the heat of an Egyptian summer, with only one day off every 30. You'll sleep in the open air, trudge behind multi-ton stones held in place by palm leaf ropes, wedge massive boulders into a face so steep and treacherous that at least 1,600 pyramid climbing tourists fell to their deaths before the practice was banned. You'll endure a tour of physical labor so extreme, a graveyard of pyramid workers suggests most suffered extreme arthritis, some lost limbs, and the average worker died at 35 years old, and you'll do it all wearing open-toed shoes. But let's say you don't show up at just any time during the 25-year construction. Let's say you join just as the pyramid reaches nearly half its eventual height. That would put you in Giza in time to help haul what might be the single most impressive and inexplicably placed rock in human history, an 80-ton solid black granite slab as heavy as the largest Moai stone somehow maneuvered onto the ceiling of Khufu's burial chamber 210 feet above the ground. Watch your toes. Most archaeologists believe the Egyptians built the entire 2 million stone structure within 25 years, which means they must have, on average, quarried, hauled, and placed a 5,000-pound limestone block every 5 minutes during every daylight hour for an entire generation. Egyptologist and archaeologist Richard Redding tells me the project was so large it probably touched the lives of all 1 million ancient Egyptians, implying a need for labor so extensive that even if your resume is light on pyramid-building experience, you shouldn't have much trouble landing the job. As a stone-hauling pyramid builder, you will be among co-workers who are neither slaves nor full-time employees, but instead farmers, Redding explains, who Khufu conscripted for brutal 4-month tours while they were idled by the Nile's annual summer flood. Contrary to popular myth, free Egyptians, rather than slave labor, built the pyramids. But that doesn't mean you'll be free to leave, either. Conscripted labor in ancient Egypt doesn't have an exact modern equivalent, but it likely resembled the draft or obligatory military service. It was a tax Khufu applied on the local populace, but a tax of labor rather than of money. Not paying was not an option. The ancient Egyptians punished tax cheats with beatings, imprisonment, and occasionally mutilation. As a conscripted farmer, you'll sail down the Nile in mid-July when the monsoonal rains that fell in the Ethiopian highlands reach Egypt and swelled the Nile far beyond its winter banks. The Nile's annual flood brought life to this otherwise desert country. Its sediment and water transformed the banks of this parched land into one of the most productive agricultural areas in the world. But the flood also idled the ancient Egyptian farmers, who had to wait until the waters receded before they could return to their fields. Join this workforce, and you'll ride the currents of the Nile from the farms in the south of Egypt and sail into a harbor dug into the Giza Plateau to allow the thousands of ships delivering the tools, stones, food, materials, and workers to flow directly to the enormous national project. When you arrive in the harbor, you'll see the massive half-built pyramid of Giza rising 200 feet above the plateau, with its sides glistening in its white limestone cladding. But perhaps even more impressive than the pyramid itself is the massive work camp you'll see beneath it. Egyptologists had long assumed the pyramid workers must have lived nearby, but they didn't discover the work camp until 1990, when a tourist riding on horseback tripped over a stone wall peeking above the sand and revealed a city of stunning sophistication and size. Egypt's farmers in their daily lives had most likely never seen more than 100 people at any one time, yet as they flowed into the Giza harbor, they arrived in a work camp occupied by as many as 30,000. The camp wasn't just large for a work project. At its height, it was one of the world's largest cities. It contained bakeries, fish processing facilities, and stockyards, all designed for mass food production. It had a series of large military-style barracks capable of housing at least 2,000 people, though, as a manual laborer, you won't merit a bed or even a roof. Initially, Redding tells me, archaeologists believed temporary manual laborers, like yourself, lived inside these cities, but now, he says, most believe the barracks would have been far too small to house the massive swell of seasonal workers. Instead, only boat crews and traveling VIPs likely slept in them. You're neither, so you'll sleep on the ground. To fit in among the crew, you'll need to look the part. Egyptian men work in kilts with nothing underneath, while women wear long, narrow dresses or sheaths with shoulder straps. Men often go shirtless, though you probably shouldn't. It regularly reaches 110 degrees, so add a linen shirt to protect your skin from the sun. Open-toed leather sandals are the typical footwear, even while wedging up multi-ton stones. Perhaps even more unfortunately, the traditional workman hairdo resembles a bowl cut. Thankfully, the pharaoh feeds his workers well. Most farmers probably ate better while working at the pyramid than they did at home. The skilled, housed laborers ate a quarter pound of beef per day, a remarkable luxury considering cattle had to be herded from their distant pastures in the delta, and a single cow cost an Egyptian craftsman a year's worth of wages. Archaeologists have found so many bones, they believe the camp consumed 4,000 pounds of beef daily, which would have required a Herculean logistical effort to procure, and stands as testament to the extraordinary resources Khufu put toward his tomb. Unfortunately, while the skilled craftsmen merit this lavish expense, you do not. As a manual laborer, Redding says, you will probably eat catfish, goat, or cow's feet stew, along with a chunk of stale bread, which you'll need to dip in your beer to soften. Beer seems like a perilous choice of beverage, considering you'll soon be placing a multi-ton block on the edge of a very steep slope. But you need not be concerned, at least not for your sobriety. Egyptian beer was more nutritious than alcoholic. It was a somewhat filling drink with the slight alcoholic tang of a kombucha. After breakfast, with a belly full of beer, bread, and cow's feet, you'll set out with a 20-man work team. If you are a member of the quarrying group, you'll receive a copper chisel. Copper is soft and thus a poor metal for chiseling rock, but it's better than the era's alternatives. And because it was sourced from small copper mines across the Red Sea, it's expensive. So don't lose it. Egyptian authorities went to great lengths to ensure it was not lost or stolen, even going so far as to weigh the amount of copper each worker took into the field. If you return with less than you should, expect a consequential conversation. Yet as a seasonal worker, you won't quarry rock. Quarriers worked year-round preparing huge numbers of limestone blocks that would then be lifted into place when the swell of summer labor arrived. You are that labor. So, after breakfast, you and the rest of the crew will set out to haul rock. You might think the mood would be somewhat morose among this conscripted crew whose taxes, time, and backbreaking labor was going toward a massive monolith in the middle of the desert. But hieroglyphic graffiti suggests an esprit de corps developed among these laborers. Work crews dubbed themselves team names like the King's Drunkards or Friends of Khufu, competed against one another, and exchanged competitive banter. Rather than haul rocks in lonely misery, it seems they hauled rocks reveling in their collective misery. Exactly how they moved those stones has been a matter of scholarly debate since the ancient Greek historian Herodotus marveled at the pyramids in 450 BCE. Remarkably, despite images and writings that describe some of the minutest details of their lives, no hieroglyph yet found describes exactly how the Egyptians built their great pyramids. That ambiguity has caused everyone from the ancient Herodotus to Napoleon to speculate on their method, with theories ranging from pulleys to alien technology. But Redding explains that recent archaeological discoveries provide a firm answer. There were no tricks, no aliens, nor barely any technology at all. Instead, he says, they used ropes, sleds, ramps, and the key ingredient, back-breaking, OSHA-disregarding, ligament-straining, and even limb-risking amounts of human pulling power. Archaeologists have found evidence of the sledges and ropes, along with hieroglyphs showing how they used both. One image in the tomb of Jehudi-Hotep shows 172 workers hauling a colossal 58-ton statue more than 20 miles over flat terrain using nothing but ropes, a sled, and a water-lubricated path. The Egyptians used this technique to pull the limestone blocks up ramps that they then disassembled after the pyramid's completion. But the design of that ramp system remains, as the Egyptologist Mark Lehner writes, one of the thorniest problems in all of pyramid building. The problem is that every design would have involved significant trade-offs. First, the ramp would have had to ascend at a reasonable grade to reduce strain on the lifting team. However, a long, gentle ramp to the top would have required more material than the entire pyramid itself, so that seems implausible. Secondly, employing switchbacks, the typical solution to climb a steep grade would require hauling teams to somehow navigate sharp turns while pulling stones with elongated ropes. Finally, using the pyramid face itself as a ramp would require unacceptably long ropes. In other words, the pyramid builders must have constructed a ramp, but it could not have been a long one, it could not have been a short one, nor could it have taken any turns. You can see the problem. The theories various scholars have supported corresponds to whichever problem they see as slightly more surmountable than the others. But Redding tells me recent archaeological discoveries in the Giza limestone quarry, which the pyramid builders dug just a quarter mile from the pyramid's base, have provided a firm answer to Herodotus's ancient question. At the bottom of the quarry, beneath stone chippings and debris, archaeologists have found the remains of an old ramp that ascends to the surface at a reasonable 11% grade. Today, it stops at the top of the quarry. But if the ramp continued its trajectory, Redding explains, it would arrive at the pyramid's southwest corner at approximately 120 feet of altitude. That's only a quarter of the way to the top, but by then, more than half of the limestone blocks would have been laid. From there, Lehner proposes the ramp looped up and around the backside of the pyramid with gentle turns that haulers could navigate because the stones at the top of the pyramid trend smaller. Once the pyramid was complete, the builders disassembled the ramp and dumped its rocks into the obvious place, the giant pit they had just dug, which explains the massive piles of stone chippings found in the quarry. It now seems clear that to move the blocks onto the pyramid, the Egyptians weren't aided by advanced levers, alien technology, or really even any technology. They simply dragged them on sledges from the bottom of the quarry up a long quarter-mile ascent at a grade twice as steep as the steepest highway in the United States. Like any job involving hard manual labor, your first few days will be the most dangerous. Before your body acclimatizes to Egypt's 100-degree summer heat, you won't sweat efficiently, and your heart will beat too quickly. You're out of rock-hauling shape and unused to the kind of hydration required for working in these conditions. According to OSHA, almost half of heat-related deaths occur on a worker's first day on the job, and more than 70% occur during the first week. If you experience dizziness, headaches, muscle cramps, or nausea, you need to retreat to the shade. If those symptoms progress to vomiting, faint pulse, or confusion, it may be too late. In modern times, an IV might save you. Here, there isn't even ice. You may be tempted to cool off in the Nile, but you probably shouldn't. The river teems with the blood parasite schistosomes, a flat worm that burrows through the skin, travels through the venous system to the liver, matures, and lays eggs along the intestinal wall. 4 to 6 weeks after infection, you'll develop a fever and become extremely lethargic. Eventually, the infection becomes chronic, and depending on where the eggs flow, they can cause intestinal disease, cancers, seizures, or death. Schistosomiasis is considered by the CDC to be the world's second most devastating parasite after malaria, and archaeologists have detected it on numerous ancient Egyptian mummies. Footnote: having contracted this particular parasite, I can confirm that if you become infected, you won't feel like hauling heavy rocks. Workplace accidents will also be a significant problem. Even climbing the pyramid will be dangerous, let alone while pulling, pushing, levering, and maneuvering multi-ton blocks on it. The pyramid's face wasn't vertical, but at 52 degrees, it was close enough. If you fall, you'll slam down the sides before you finally hit the ground. Unsurprisingly, skeletons in the workers' cemetery in Giza show signs of significant fractures in their arms, legs, and hands. Fortunately, many of those fractures healed, suggesting doctors immobilized them in splints. Some even seem to have survived amputations. So, if you're injured, it seems medical care is available, though whether you should accept it depends on your malady. Ancient Egyptian doctors were fairly proficient at caring for traumatic bone injuries. A papyrus describing treatment for a broken nose doesn't differ much from what you would receive today, but medications for internal or indirect causes of suffering, such as arthritis, disease, or parasites, were not nearly as effective. Medical papyri run legion with revolting prescriptions for diseases, including ointments of animal dung and broths of dead flies and cooked mice. The list of prescriptions suggests that if the cause of your injury is obvious, say if a falling rock crushes your arm, you should seek medical care, but if you sicken, you probably shouldn't. As you drag each limestone block from the quarry to the work surface of the pyramid, you'll place it under the watchful eye of chief builder Hemiunu, one of Khufu's most powerful viziers and the director of all royal projects. Footnote: this has recently become a matter of some debate. For most of the 20th century, Egyptologists believed Hemiunu to be the chief pyramid architect after deciphering hieroglyphs on his tomb beneath the Great Pyramid that identified him as such. But in 2013, archaeologists cast that claim into some doubt after discovering the diary of one of the pyramid builders at a site near the Red Sea. This remarkable papyrus, the oldest ever discovered, was written by an official named Merer, who was charged with shipping the pyramid's white limestone blocks from their quarry in Tura to Giza. In it, Merer writes that Khufu's half-brother, Ankaf, served as the project's director. You'll have to reconcile the debate. But far from inventing the architectural concepts necessary for the Great Pyramid's construction, Hemiunu owes a great architectural debt to Imhotep, and later to Khufu's father king, Sneferu. Imhotep was the healer, architect, and vizier to Khufu's great-grandfather, King Djoser, and he invented the predecessor to the pyramid by innovating on the traditional Egyptian bench-like tomb known as a mastaba. Instead of building one bench to house Djoser's remains, he built a series of benches stacked on top of each other, like a giant wedding cake. King Sneferu took Imhotep's idea and improved upon it. He developed the building techniques necessary to turn Imhotep's wedding cake design into Egypt's famous smooth-faced pyramids, though that research hardly came without cost. In his first two attempts at pyramid building, King Sneferu made critical errors. He built his pyramids on soft ground and then compounded this mistake by angling the sides too steeply. The steep sides put tremendous pressure on the pyramid's outer edges, which gradually sank into the sand as the pyramid grew. Sneferu's first try collapsed before completion, and his second, known as the Bent Pyramid, developed such severe cracks that he had to dramatically decrease the angle of the pyramid halfway through construction, hence the name. Sneferu did finish the Bent Pyramid, but due to aesthetic or stability concerns, he never used it. Instead, he learned from his failures and built Egypt's first successful true pyramid, the Red Pyramid, on a foundation of solid rock. He then passed on his knowledge and his obsession to his son Khufu and to his architect, and your boss, Hemiunu. Hemiunu chose the Giza Plateau for his King Khufu pyramid likely because of its proximity to both the Nile and a suitable limestone quarry, as well as the quality of its strong limestone bedrock, which streaks from northeast to southwest through the plateau and explains the diagonal orientation of the three Giza pyramids. Hemiunu clearly learned from Sneferu's mistakes, as he not only chose to build on bedrock, but paid meticulous attention to the pyramid's foundation. Modern architects calculate the Great Pyramid's base to be flat to within less than a half inch, across an area almost 10 football fields in size, a feat he accomplished using nothing but wood, A-frames, and plumb lines to carefully correct irregularities, yard by yard. Hemiunu then oriented the faces of the pyramid in the exact cardinal directions with an error of less than 0.1 degree, He did this not by compass, but by carefully observing and then measuring the exact locations of the rise and fall of the night stars. He then measured out the initial base of the pyramid using a stick called a cubit so that all four sides were perfectly equal. Finally, as the pyramid rose, he took continual measurements to keep the face at the proper angle and to keep the corners perfectly aligned. His design required precision, expert masonry, and Snefru's hard-earned experience, but it didn't require remarkable mathematical ability or architectural genius. Khufu's Great Pyramid doesn't stand testament to Egypt's scientific or technological achievements, but it does testify to its remarkable bureaucratic ones. Constructing the pyramid represents an extraordinary marshaling of a nation's resources toward a single goal, like the Manhattan Project carried out over a generation. In order to build his great tomb, Khufu synchronized the movements of his entire nation toward a single purpose. He built one of the world's largest cities out of nothing, housed and fed its occupants for more than 20 years, arranged for the mining of copper from across the Red Sea, quarried and shipped black granite from Aswan and white limestone from Tura, and organized the conscription of tens of thousands of farmers every year. To build his great pyramid, Khufu reached into the lives of nearly every one of his more than 1 million subjects and bent them toward a single goal. Khufu managed this massive organizational challenge by employing the most civil servants per capita in history, and then structuring his bureaucracy in a manner bearing remarkable resemblance to modern militaries. His tens of thousands of government employees of descending rank worked in four branches of government: the royal court, the army, the church, and civil government. To requisition the resources for his pyramid, employees of his treasury fanned out across the country and assigned each head of Egypt's 42 regions, or nomes, a tax. Because ancient Egypt relied on a system of sophisticated barter rather than money, taxes were based upon whatever the region produced. The nomes of the Nile Delta, for example, paid in cattle, while in the south they paid in grain. Tax rates hovered around 10%, but rather than measure each farmer's production, which would have encouraged farmers to hide their crops, the treasury measured the height of the Nile's flood using nilometers and, referencing past year's production as a guide, assigned each region a tax based on how much they had historically produced under those conditions. During periods of pyramid construction, part of a region's tax included the 4 months of backbreaking labor you're now providing. When I asked Egyptologist Colleen Darnell whether she had any advice for you as you labor, she told me ancient Egyptian wisdom literature suggests the culture had clear mores. Don't steal, don't get drunk on the job, and people who complained were frowned upon, she says. So as you rise to work on your 28th straight day hauling rocks in the heat beneath a summer Egyptian sun, try to keep a stiff upper lip. Of all the dangers you face during your tour, a buffet of peril that includes parasites, heat, disease, food, and towering heights, nothing will compare to the life-threatening risk you confront the moment you line up to haul the 80-ton black granite slab. Judging by the Jehuti-Hotep hieroglyph, ancient Egyptians organized their pulling teams so that each puller pulled with approximately 150 pounds of force, roughly the same force required to pull a large car on a flat road. Studies of tug-of-war competitors suggest the average athlete can pull with 1.5 times their body weight. So, while the weight is certainly possible if you're a healthy adult, it falls significantly outside the bounds of OSHA recommendations of 50 pounds. That fact probably explains the serious signs of degenerative back and knee arthritis found in the skeletons of 30-somethings in the Pyramid Workers' Cemetery. Fortunately, you can mitigate these degenerative injuries if you pull with proper technique. To learn how to safely haul a rope, I turned to Mick Cooper, secretary for the English Tug of War Association, who tells me he has 50 years of tug of war experience. He offered a few pieces of advice. First, don't use a heave-ho strategy. That's a technique employed by carnival teams competing for a barrel of beer, says Cooper. Serious competitors haul continuously. Second, keep your arms straight, lean back, and push with your legs. Amateurs often yell pull while hauling on a rope, but that's a mistake. Use your more powerful back and leg muscles to push, rather than pull and lean back while doing so in order to keep your back straight. That should help avoid injury. In a study on the competitors in the 1998 Tug-of-War World Championships, back sprains composed almost half of the injuries. Hand injuries made up a significant portion as well. You can partially avoid those by never, ever wrapping the rope around your hands, fingers, or any other body part. Not only can tension in the rope easily crush body parts, but if your comrades fail, you could be dragged behind the sliding rock. Unfortunately, there is an even more serious and gruesome tug-of-war danger when hauling such heavy weight. There are no diminishing returns when adding pullers to a rope, which is how hauling that 80-ton granite block is even possible, but this also means the forces can scale far beyond what would seem intuitively possible. The ancient Egyptians were clearly aware of this latent human pulling power, but the immense forces deployed by huge pulling teams have deceived more modern minds to occasionally tragic effect. On June 6, 1995, a group of Boy Scouts in Frankfurt, Germany, lined up for a 650-person game of tug-of-war. When the 2-inch-thick nylon rope broke, it snapped back with such speed it killed the 2 scouts standing in front and injured 25 others. Other large tug-of-war matches have severed arms, fingers, and crushed hands. On October 25, 1997, in Taiwan, 1,600 people applied 180,000 pounds of force to a rope rated for less than half that. The severed line ripped backward with such force it tore the arms off the 2 people in front. If we assume the Egyptians used the same principles to pull the 80-ton granite slab as the Jehudi-Hotep hieroglyph depicts, then to haul the 80-ton rock up the 11% grade, you'll pull with at least 343 ancient Egyptian pullers standing alongside. Together, you'll be pulling with enough force to rip apart a half-inch piece of rebar. Fortunately, there's evidence that Egyptian palm-fibered ropes could withstand immense strain. Even so, when Hemiunu orders that 80-ton stone block onto a sledge and directs you and 343 others to take your places along the ropes, you probably shouldn't stand in front.